How are you all doing? The second day of Sesshin starts to feel like we're moving. We've been to before, but we haven't visited for a little while. A unique place. And looking at these stories of a transmission of light. Which seems to me like they're, like I previously mentioned, they're kind of like Zazen instructions. I think the heart stories can be seen that way. The center of an interaction that's pointing out some direct principle of practice. Hopefully encouraging stories that shed light on a new angle of our practice. And at the same time, I feel like these stories, I kind of forget about it, about this aspect, until we get into it, which is they're all about these relationships between these teachers and students in the lineage. Sometimes even seems more prominent than the stories themselves. And like today's story is a case like that, where Keizan's commentary is one of maybe the longest ones here, where it's all about the intricacies of transmission and relationship. And he says hardly anything about the story, the central awakening story. So I think that's an inescapable part of this. And something like, somehow I feel a little tension or something just around the whole issue. I don't know how other people feel about this issue of relationships and transmission and these things, and somehow it's so personal, and I don't know. We've been having some discussions, the leadership of Zen Center, about issues of hierarchy and vertical and horizontal and things like this. So without going into all the nitty-gritty details. We think about these things. These are concerns for our present-day life, particularly around institutions like Zen centers. And there's something very delicate, I think, about these relationships. And there's so many different styles. So my relationship with my root teacher, Tenshin Roshi, as I mentioned recently, you know, I saw him in Dokusan, you know, almost every week when we were both around together for the almost 20 years, but those are these very formal meetings, and we had other kinds of meetings too, but they were mostly quite formal. And for example, in all those those years, I don't recall ever like kind of going out to a movie with him, or I don't think I ever went out to a meal with him, never had dinner, apart from Orioki. And, you know, the Zen Center dining room. So it's a strange kind of relationship. One of the most intimate ones of my life, and yet, from a certain perspective, you could say that's not intimate at all. It's so kind of formal and in that case, very hierarchical. I feel like we are actually close friends, and at the same time, there's this always this sense, I think, of disciple and teacher. And that's his style, you know, so that's, it wasn't just with me, I think amongst all his senior disciples, maybe very few of them have ever gone out to dinner with him. Maybe it can be kind of lonely, you know, he's got a family, but. And within San Francisco Zen Center, there's many different styles. And then maybe closer to the other end of the spectrum, and I don't know so much, maybe Ellen can tell us more about Coben. You know, she said the other day in his monthly memorial, Coben was a real friend. And in fact, a teacher means, one of the ancient Buddhist terms for teacher is Kalyanamitra, which means like good friend. So, and I feel like I have that with my teacher, but it's a certain kind of unusual kind of friendship. But Coben maybe liked to have a little more informal kind of friendships, like what I had, just a handful of interactions and being around Coben over the years. One of them was at an ordination, and he did a priest ordination at Hokoji in New Mexico, and it was a friend of mine, so I was there for that ceremony. After the ordination, it's on kind of Native American, or maybe right next to a Native American reservation. So there was a powwow that night. So the local tribe put on all their feathers and dance and so on, and Coben loved that kind of thing. So the whole group went to the powwow afterwards, and I remember being a little surprised when Coben started passing around a joint to draw his students, sharing it with them. I thought, oh, yeah, it's a different kind of relationship. Very warm, I think, and you know, it was, he did a quite formal Zen ceremony, ordaining a student as a priest in this very traditional way, an hour before that. So I think there's all different ways and styles, and they're all beneficial, and they're all like, depend on the person, you know? Yeah.
But when I was at City Center during the practice period, there were a lot of young students there, and there were a lot of students there, and there was a very kind of, with lots of angst and energy question to Paul. Well, I mean, what is all this, you know, above and below, and what is it? Mm-hmm. Is there a heart hierarchy or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely so. And I
think so.
That's really stayed with me because I think it's so true and so helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have these forms that seem very hierarchical, and yet in no sense is there better than. It's almost like I don't have a
system. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, this no big deal at the same time?
Yeah, very interesting, huh? Yeah, yeah. Everyone in the world is equally nourished by this vase that never empties. And then, yeah, Dharma positions is an interesting one, which is used, you know, an important term for Dogen in terms of, like, every phenomena is abiding in its Dharma position. But Sojin Roshi Mel Weitzman, I remember he would, for years and years, he'd come to Tassajara at the beginning of the summer season where all the roles were changing and everybody had a new position. Some people didn't like them, some people did. And did he come at the beginning of the summer, Emily? He did? Did he talk about Dharma positions? Not specifically. I just remember for many years he'd give the same Dharma talk about Dharma positions and particularly about, you know, all these roles kind of look different and stuff, but just they're all actually, they are different and they're totally equal, kind of like what you're saying, and just abide in your Dharma position completely, and each person doing that supports everybody else. And, you know, we don't want to get stuck in anyone, so we mix it up sometimes. But I think people found that helpful. And, you know, I think this is part of also the transition of Buddhism to America, because I think Asian culture has more of this maybe hierarchical kind of thing built into it, like filial piety towards one's parents even is very big over there. It's kind of maybe becoming more and more almost non-existent in a Western world. Democracy rules. I also recall a story that I can't remember where it might be in one of these books, like Crooked Cucumber or something, but it might be an oral transmission. And I can't remember the characters, but in the back of my storehouse, I have a sense that maybe it was Maizumi Roshi actually talking to somebody like either Richard Baker or Tenchin Anderson in their early days of teaching. It was somebody kind of like new as an abbot maybe, and who didn't have like a jisha and anja, these kind of attendant positions that are kind of look a little hierarchical, like a, not just an incense attendant, but like taking care of their, cleaning their room and stuff like that. And whoever it was, say it was Maizumi Roshi, kind of came to visit Zen Center and said, oh, it looks like you don't have a jisha and an anja. And that American teacher said, no, I don't need that. I can, you know, I can clean my own room. And it feels a little funny, you know. I really don't need that. And Maizumi Roshi said, it's not about you. It's not that you need it. It's for the student. And I think that was a surprise for that person. It was, oh, really?
Yeah, I was going to say it probably was Maizumi Roshi, and that was definitely the feeling that to be the jisha for the teacher was such an honor, because it's always being transmitted to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have such a personal, close relationship.
Yeah.
And yeah, all the teachers there have teachers.
The Americans too.
Pardon?
The American teachers too.
Oh yeah.
Of course, it's also, I think it's different in a bigger monastic container. Because everyone has a position, and there's so many people, and they're there all the time. So,
yeah.
Kind of like the structure of running a place like that. Yeah.
I was just recalling that Tassajara was this really grouchy guy that told us where our rooms were. I was just taken back by how unpleasant he was. And my friend, who's a teacher, says
to be meeting everybody like that.
Meeting everybody and to have
that
reflective.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, often at Tassajara, the positions, maybe it used to be more this way. I think it's maybe shifting a little bit. Or it used to be more like if somebody had some special skill or something, they wouldn't be put in that position. Like, they already know that. Let's put them in some completely different realm. And for like kind of running a business, it's awful. It's totally inefficient. But for spiritual growth training, it's really great and challenging. Yes.
I think the first time I ever heard you say Dharma position was when I was Shiso, and I was really caught up in the comparative mind of trying to do it like Nanette, because I followed her, and we're so different in so many ways. And you particularly pointed out that it wasn't about me, and that I was actually serving the Sangha. Mm. And I really appreciated that reminder and that particular verbiage. You're holding a Dharma position, and we all do. And so it allowed me to shift my thinking very significantly. And I know that Patrick and Jean both had to remind me of the same thing, basically. That, oh, it's just, it's how you bring yourself forward for the benefit of others. Yeah. It's not really about you.
Mm-hmm.
And I really greatly appreciated that reminder, even though it had to be repeated.
No, repeated.
But it was great, because it was this really significant shift in my thinking, and it actually helped me to relax a little bit in that role, that that I could have a little less self in it.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. We could even say that from the perspective of these kind of teachings, you know, like we speak of the background mirror that's our true nature, and then everything that appears is just like reflections. So all these roles are just these reflection-like appearances. And so the practice is to not take it too seriously. Like, it's not just a reflection, but it's real, grasp it, and not take it so personally. This is the great challenge. So I think that, you know, that story about whoever it was who didn't want the attendant, maybe there's some feeling of like, well, I feel like if I get the attendant and it, like, really honored, it's going to kind of dangerous, because even if I don't take it personally at first, I might start to think of like, I alone am the world honored one, or something like this. So it's more dangerous maybe for the teacher actually than the student, these little games we play. Challenging for everybody, but in different ways. Yeah. I admit, I confess that I feel a little bit that way. Like maybe it's too much. So I hold back a little bit about that kind of thing. Could be, yeah. And then there's other things where some people have heard me express. I have very strong feelings about other things in this realm that are, again, kind of about the position, but and I have to be really careful that it's about the position, because then the self gets in there and I make it like a personal issue, which then I feel really, that's not really not about that. But it's easy, very easy for it to become personal investment in some Dharma point, naturally. So these are the juicy parts, I think, of our practice together, that we can't really like, and it's all about community. If we didn't have community with the structure and setup of it, we wouldn't have these opportunities. It's beautiful and challenging.
There's an interesting comparison for me in the experience of creating art, that the difference of being brought forward as opposed to having an idea and trying to make it happen. For me, that's when I always get stuck. I don't like this, I do like that, I want it to look like this, I want it to be like somebody else's, blah, blah, blah. But if I can let go of that and just let it come through me, that it's not even like having an idea. I can't even say I have an idea. Something comes through me and tells my hands what to do, what to pick up, where to put it. Oh, maybe if you tried this, or maybe you could do that. It's a completely different experience. And I can tell right away that I'm getting stuck, you know, because it's not working. I'm getting stuck in an idea about myself.
Yep. As an artist myself, I know that wanting to try to like kind of being inspired by a certain style of art and trying to kind of almost replicate it, and it doesn't work. And then sometimes when you let it come through like that, it's like a miraculous, like much greater than you could have expected. And then I imagine sometimes it's like, oh no. That's a reject.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's okay, yeah. It's okay. Exactly. Yep. Yep. That's why then you just do another one. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so delicate balance. I think the more aware we are of how we all are together, and the more open we discuss these things with great honesty, the better everything seems to work. We say, yeah. Here's a little bit from Suzuki Roshi. I brought some of this up the other day about this teacher-student thing, which I think is just, he's pointing to something related to this whole issue, too. Maybe a little bit surprising, I thought. From 1970, some talk. Generally speaking, before you become your teacher's disciple, you may receive his transmission. And I think he's maybe referring to, maybe commonly this maybe goes in Japan, because the rituals of Dharma transmission often happen when the student's quite young, and often with their father, and it's like it's time to do it and it has to be done, but the full impact maybe doesn't really hit them till later. Suzuki Roshi had the gift of not doing it with his father, even though his father was a temple priest. I think his father felt that it would be good to have this relationship with somebody, to not confuse your Dharma relationship, your Dharma position as a student with me as your father, which often is the way it works. And this is maybe this still in the somewhat early days of this new movement of passing on to one's, you know, blood son. So Gyoko Jinsoon was a student of Suzuki Roshi's father. And he said, why don't you work with him? And actually, I think it was at a different place. I think Gyoko Jinsoon then had maybe a nearby temple, and his father sent him to actually go live there, even, I think. So you may receive his transmission before you become your teacher's disciple. And after receiving transmission, a long, long time after you receive transmission, you may realize what was transmission and who was your teacher. Oh, he was my teacher. You will realize it when it's too late, maybe. But you will come to that point if you continue in your practice. So there's no need to worry. Even though you receive transmission or lay ordination, so he's any kind of, you know, relationship like this. Before, you don't know exactly what it was, even though you were ordained before you have not much understanding about the ordination ceremony. That's okay, I think. If you feel some commitment to continue your practice, then it's okay. Someday you will realize it. I thought from the beginning, I thought Gyokujin Soon was my teacher, you know? But you know, on the other hand, I found out that many years later, I was not his disciple at that time. And he laughs. I thought I was, you know. I had a strong conviction of my being disciple of my teacher, but I found out that I was not his disciple in its true sense. Now, I am his disciple, long after he's dead. But I don't know how I'll feel next year. And he laughs again. Next year I might say, oh, last year I was his disciple, yes. In this way, your teacher is always with you. Sometimes with you, but sometimes you feel he's not your teacher. Or he was not your teacher. Sometimes he will not be your teacher. But it's okay anyway. You will be his teacher. Teacher and disciple is, you know, that kind of relationship. Day after day, we have strong conviction in our relationship, but that is not complete. Our relationship should be extended forever. So you are bound to be your teacher's disciple. But this does not mean that you should stick to the idea of relationship between teacher and disciple. Whether you stick to it or not, a relationship is there. Buddha is taking care of it, whether you understand it or not. Our relationship between teacher and disciple is so wide and so deep that our small mind cannot understand what it is. There's no other way to understand this relationship. So day by day, just bow to your teacher. That's the only way. It's day-to-day practice, and practice just for that moment. Even though you don't bow to him, you're still related to him anyway. So if you don't, then you don't feel good. Because if you don't bow, then you don't feel so good. If you do, you feel good, that's all. It's not so difficult thing to bow. So better to just bow, even though you don't know who he is. Perhaps you may not understand what I'm saying right now, but actually, if you have someone you can trust, you will feel good. And if you have someone who entrusts your responsibility, you will feel good, you know. In that way, we can live forever. We will have eternal life, entrusting our responsibility, sharing our responsibility with many people. That's the relationship between teacher and disciple. And that's why we recite the sutras for our teachers every morning. I think this was a commentary on the service dedications, chanting of the list of the ancestors. So that's his commentary. Why do we chant all those long list of names? So maybe this is his. It's about these relationships, and we don't know those ancient people, but we're getting to know them in this machine. Before we go back to that, to the next Denko Roku ancestor, this is a book, Women of the Way, Sally Tisdale, up at Dharma Rain Zen Center, put together this book of women Zen ancestors in India, China, and Japan. And this is the related section. This is all related to Kazon, this compiler of the transmission of light. So we have Acharya Akon, Uchan Hernania, Akon Daishi was separated from her mother at the age of 18. Several years later, she went to Kiyomitsu Temple in Kyoto to pray for help in finding her. I think it means that her mother didn't necessarily die, it just somehow she was lost. She ran off or something. The temple's waters are magically healing, and so faithful people come to drink every day. For a week, she went to the temple each morning and prayed and drank this water. On the sixth day, she saw the carved head of Kanon, Guanyin, on the ground, lying in the mud. It was small, finely carved. Finding it there seemed auspicious and strange, so she put her palms together and made a vow. "If you have pity for me," she said to this bodhisattva's head, help me find my mother. If you do, I will have a body carved for you and honor you the rest of my life." Then she carefully picked up the head, took it home, and washed it clean. The next day, on the last day of her prayers, she met a woman on the road who put out her hand to stop her. The woman smiled and then told her where to find her mother. So Daishi, Akon, took the wooden kanon head to a craftsman and commissioned a body made to fit. Only then did she go to a nearby town to be reunited with her mother, who had been Dogen's lay disciple when she was young. Many years later, when Akon was 37, she had a dream. She swallowed the morning light, warm and soft as silk, and it filled her entire body. A few days later, she realized she was pregnant. Then she prayed, as she often had prayed, to the beloved statue of Kanon. "May this child be a spiritual leader, a benefit to all, and please may the delivery be easy." For the next 7 months, she bowed 1,333 times each day and recited the Kanon Sutra. So she skipped the last 2 months of pregnancy because she didn't want to crush the baby with her prostrations. Could be. Could be. The baby was born on the property of the Kanon Temple in the province of Echizen, which is where Eheji is, without pain. A short while later, Akon took vows as a nun, and the baby's grandmother helped raise him. When Akon could, she took the baby to her favorite temple in Kyoto, Sanju San Gendo, the temple of 33,000 kanons. Which is, have you been?
Yeah.
This place still exists.
It was there the day that I conceived
myself. Wow. So maybe you are an incarnation of Akon. Very mysterious, yeah. And you know, this book, a lot of these are stories that I've seen in other historical records of Kazon, but Sally Tisdale wrote this in this, she kind of, I know there's some stories later where she's talking about conversations and the way the light is in the room, and where I think she's making it more a nicer read. But I think stories like this are probably historical. I don't think she would just make up that kind of story. Sanju San Gendo's is an amazing temple where 33,000 kanons, and they're like life size and like really exquisitely detailed. Every little robe and jewelry and like halo radiating, and all like in rows and rows, like just, you know, to be in that is like walking into some kind of pure land. You can't even like kind of see down that, it's a long narrow building, they're all in these kind of like tiers and rows, and you can't even really see the end of them, they're so far away. This is like the kind of devotion to build that kind of thing. So she took her baby there. It was a place of gold and shadow. The sculptures filled her eyes, her mind, endless, sparkling, and strange. She wanted the images and spirit of Canon to fill the baby's mind, the baby destined to be a great leader. Since Dogen's death many decades before, the Soto school had become firmly established. When he was 8 years old, Daishi sent her son to Eheiji. Kind of young, maybe. Where he was called, guess what he was called? Keizan! Eikan's son was Keizan. He trained for many years under Tetsu Gikai. His mother eventually founded a Soto convent named Jōjūji, becoming its abbot around 1309. Stan asked yesterday, were there women abbots? Yep. Keizan's mom. Men left, women stayed behind. This was the way of Buddhism. In Keizan's case, his mother left him first, but in some way they never really left each other at all. They visited often. He relied on her advice and she prayed for him from before his birth until the day of her own death. Keizan founded the temple of Daijoji in Kanazawa and began to write the great collection of ancestral stories we call the Denko Roku, transmission of light. While still living at Daijoji, Keizan met Mokufu Sonin, Acharya Mokufu Sonin. We chant her name in the mornings too. Her name was subtle and intricate. It meant ordered silence and enduring ancestor. Sonin had married Shigen Nobunao when she was 13. They went off to practice in the monastery young and they got married young. In 1312, she donated a large amount of land in a place called Tokoku and asked Keizan to build a temple there. There was no money for building until Sonin's brother died. After that, she had the family home dismantled and rebuilt on the land as a temple. In 1317, Keizan entered this building formally as the abbot of Yokoji. It was a long way in, more than miles from Kyoto to Yokoji, out on the peninsula, broken by emerald rice paddies in the lowlands where white egrets bob their heads among the silvery shoots. At this time, it was still wild land with pigs, bears, and snakes loose on the hills, and only a few farmers for neighbors in most places. The weather was difficult, typhoons in the summer, blizzards in the winter, rain the rest of the time. Nevertheless, the land was beautiful, azure and rich, thick with bamboo and cypress. Yokoji quarters were very rough. The snow was deep in the winter and the stream below ran hard. The residents were so poor they had to make tea from pine needles, but all the geomancy was correct. I've heard that story elsewhere too. Keizan's group had to make tea from pine needles. I don't think, so she didn't make that one up. Like his mother, Kazan had many prophetic dreams that divided his life into clear segments and led him toward his future. His dreams about Yokoji were strong and good, filled with spirits and Buddhas. He believed he could see the true monastery already there, the one belonging to the other world, the world of protectors and guides. In this place where the boundary between worlds was very thin, he would build the monastery of eternal light, Yokoji. Kazan's dream record, we have parts of in English. He had some really far out dreams. A year later, Akon died. Almost at the moment of her death, she reached for her son's hand. "I made a vow to Kanon," she said. "You must continue. You must help all beings to come to the Dharma. Most especially, because you can, you must help all women of the three worlds and 10 directions. Take the little statue," she added, nodding toward the Kanon she had found all those years ago in the mud. "Take care of it forever." In her memory, Kazan ordered that a Soto women's temple, Ho-Oji, be built in the province of Kaga. One night, Kazan dreamed that his grandmother came to him and asked to be ordained. The next day, Sonin, who was still very young, invited Kazan to engage in Dharma combat with her. The spirited, metaphor-laden interview testing a student's understanding. So this is Mokufu Sonin, who's his patron, donor. Kazan asked Sonin, "This year is almost gone and another new year will come. So how about your practice life?" Sonin answered, "In the branches of the tree without shadow, is there any kind of time?" Excellent. Kazan was pleased. Here was a person with deep and earnest mind with the flavor of Dharma in her words. Already he trusted her. Already they were like master and disciple, as well as friends. When she asked him to ordain her, he could not have been happier. Because of his dream, he believed from then on that Sonin was his grandmother reborn. Well, I guess if His grandmother reborn. Because he had this dream that his grandmother came to ask to be ordained. So she came in the form of Sonin. In her wish wasn't fulfilled then, however. She remained in lay life, a married woman of property and a patron, as well as his friend at that time. In 1321, the Buddha Hall was built. That season, a nun named Konto Ekyu, Acharya Ekyu, arrived and immediately made herself at home, as though she'd always lived there. Since she couldn't read Chinese well, Kazan rewrote Dogen's discussion of the precepts in Japanese for her. Because some of Dogen's writings were in classical Chinese. So he kind of rewrote it because the women didn't have the same opportunities of education. So he helped her to learn this text on the precepts. She began to organize the nuns and manage their work. Month by month, season by season, more buildings and more altars were built and more people came until dozens of monks and almost 30 nuns lived in the community. A lot of early Soto Zen women practitioners. The men and women sat together for morning services, then separated to do their work and study. The residents studied the Lotus Sutra, the Brahmajala Sutra on the Bodhisattva precepts, and the Buddha's Brief Admonitions Parinirvana Sutra. Kazan gave them Dogen's rules for the daily life in the temple, rules for the zendo and relating to each other for meals, using the library, how to use the toilet. Dogen, of course, had detailed instructions on all these things. In 1319, a woman named Annie, we don't chant her name, I don't think, huh? A member of a powerful local family donated a large amount of rice paddy land to Yokoji. It was enough to pay off the mortgage. That same year, Keizan ordained Sonin on the sixth day of the 8th month. Because of the original donation of land from her and her family, Keizan fondly called Sonin the fundamental overlord of the mountain after that. In 1322, Keizan and the nuns founded Ensuin, the temple of perfect penetration, across the stream from the mountain gate hidden in the trees. Ensuin was dedicated to the well-being of women forever, and it was most especially meant as an honor to his grandmother. It was a tiny place up a narrow winding path, held closely by big cedars on every side. At the dedication, the statue of Kanzeon, with its 11 serene faces, was installed as the main image. It had come to seem like an animate thing, hearing and acting on the prayers of its bearers. In its base, Keizan placed a lock of his own baby hair and his umbilical cord, which his mother had preserved. I wonder if anybody still keeps their umbilical cords. It's like putting these relics into the statue. In this way, he gave his own life to this women's hermitage in the trees. Sonin was the first abbot there. So, Ensuin was forbidden to men, as parts of the main building were forbidden to women. That's how it was in the old days. But Keizan remembered the vow he'd inherited, and he lectured to the women, sometimes meeting privately with them to guide their studies. For years they lived there in quiet intimacy. Sonin's mother began studying under Keizan. So that's Sonin's mother. Soon she made a large donation of many rice paddies, and this was enough to help support the temple. Keizan gave her the precepts in 1323 and the name Shouzen. A chart. What's her name? Shouzen. No? Acharya? No, we don't. Shouzen? Do we? Shouzen. The very last name. The very last name? No, Chiyono. Acharya Shouzen. Eikan Shouzen Mokufu Sonin. So those three, Shouzen, Eikan, and Mokufu Sonin, are all students of Keizan. Shouzen, which means meditation on nature. He wrote a poem for her and offered her a small hut hidden in the folds of the hills above the temple called Zokean, to use as a hermitage. After that, he called her a priest and said sutras and offertories should be read forever in her honor. On a day in early spring, a perfect day, the one day each spring that promises so many more such days to come, On that day, Keizan bowed to Ekyu after the morning service and asked her to come to his reception room for tea. Ekyu folded her robes, spoke briefly to the other nuns about the work projects for the day, and then slowly walked along the wooden cloister. The light came in under the eaves, the tall pines outside the walls. Keizan's room behind sliding rice paper doors. He knelt on one side of a low table. She entered and knelt on the other. They were such good friends by then, and she was so comfortable with, she was so comfortably his student, and he so comfortably her confidant, that nothing needed to be said while he whisked the tea. She looked beyond him into the tiny courtyard. A plant was beginning to spread its wide green leaves beneath the tree. Keizan offered the bowl of tea, watched while she tasted it. He said, "I'm giving this to you. Here." He handed her a scroll, a document of succession that declared her to be his Dharma heir. She received it gravely, but he could see the smile in her dark eyes. Then he gave her a self-portrait with some calligraphy, a line or two of scripture. They finished tea, and she rose, bowed, and went to work. The first Japanese woman to receive the full Soto Zen Dharma transmission. It was Ekyu, yeah, Ekyu. Yeah, yeah, Acharya Ekyu. And, now who was that again? What was the original relationship? It's not Mokufuso-nin, and it's not Akon. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 right. Yeah, yeah, she's not a relative or donor, just a practitioner totally devoted to helping organize and take care of the place. Another day, Keizan invited Sonin to his room. He also gave Sonin a portrait and calligraphy, a transmission, and something else. He had written in careful lines a document pairing their descendants in a kind of marriage agreement. Keizan's descendants and Sonin's descendants bound in the future. I wonder if that's a true story. They had this, you know, patron relationship, but then both of the husband and wife both got ordained, and both practiced with Keizan at the temple. Could be, like, yeah, there is like Hoban, right, changed families at some point.
Right, right, and I have a friend whose father wasn't a priest, and he got married to his daughter, and she was raised as a priest, so he became part of the disciple of the father.
Interesting.
So he ended up finding another name.
Yeah, so I think maybe some more flexibility around actually family relationships in that culture.
Yeah.
Almost like adoption.
Right.
But even changing one's name to join a new family. This sounds like something like he just felt like there was so much connection between these families. He made some document to express it. Yeah.
How do you think the story, it's in English now, so I get what you said, this is a translation of another story. How is this whole story passed down?
How is it passed down?
Yeah, this little history of
Kedan. Yeah, it's a lot here, and as I say, I think she embellishes a little bit, maybe, and pulls from different sources and very nicely puts them all together in this chapter. But there are records, you know, in those days people were, Kedan himself, I recently heard, he was very into sort of like an archivist. He was really into keeping like a lot of journals and records of his own. So we have Kazan's kind of like informal sort of records, that not just his Dharma writings, like I think a bit like even like bills for how much things cost and stuff like that. So we still have a lot of those, and I think he certainly with his transmissions and things like that, he would be recording that. So
written
documents that got passed along, and maybe some of it was discovered later, because maybe at this time it was all new. No one would know that Kazan would become this really important founding ancestor. It was just a little fledgling movement still, you know, active, but maybe they didn't think that records would be so important. But now, how great, right, that people kept these records and passed them along. It was like 1300s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A while ago. But not so different. Not so different. So, you know, this is taking a lot of time, but just think, you might never hear again all these women students of Kazan. So here's another one. Kazan's cousin was ordained not long after that. She was called Myosho Enkan. We chant her name. Yeah. That's Kazan's cousin. Her name meant bright whole vision. She and Sonin became close friends, and Myosho Enkan proved to be quite adept at Zen. It wasn't long before Sonin recognized her capacity and gave her the authority to ordain others. So it sounds like a kind of transmission now from Sonin, like a kind of women's lineage starting here. Kazan decided to test Myosho Enkan's understanding. He said, "Do you understand the story about Lin Ji raising up the whisk?" And, you know, saying, like, "Do you understand?" Kazan asked. Myosho looked at him and remained silent. He was pleased with this answer. As he turned to leave, he said, "Your words are difficult to contain in ink." And this relates to the story for today, if we ever get to it. When Shozen died in 1325, Kazan declared that everyone at the monastery do monthly memorials and an annual service in her honor. He began to then prepare for his own death, parceling out temples to his disciples, since he had quite a few of them. Ho-Oji remained a convent for nuns with Sonin, the abbot, and she lived there until 80. Even now in Yokoji, there is a scroll of Eikan and Mokufu Sonin as abbots of Ensuin sitting side by side.
Now that gives a little flavor.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's nice to know. So here we're, you know, getting to know the male ancestors and that lineage, and now it's nice to know those. That's maybe actually about five of them are all Kazan's students and related. And a couple are Dogen's, like Egi, Acharya Egi is Dogen's priest, disciple, and maybe others too on that list. It does sound that way. Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of the things that, like, some of the stories, it's a little bit like I read the other day about what is truth? Did all these ancestor stories, are they like historically true? And it's like, and the for those who weren't here, in the introduction, Francis Cook says, stories like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, you know, historically it probably didn't really happen, but it's a true story because it's a great teaching point for all of us who relate to it.
Cyprian likes to talk about that as myth.
Yeah.
You know, that those stories are true. Myths are often very, very true. They contain a truth that you can't transmit any other way.
Yep. Yeah, I think in our conversation, he said something in this myth, and I use that in the best sense of the word. I think is how
exactly.
He said it.
I had this teacher, Angela Arian, who said practices for us to learn how to tell stories.
Ah.
So we are practiced with tell three stories, and the people that we're telling, they have to guess which one is true. And it's really good practice.
Huh.
So we hold that as a practice.
Try to tell it as if it's true.
I'll tell a true story.
Yeah. A true story that that's valuable to keep passing down. Especially if we get into, like, you know, it really happened in Buddha Dharma is a little bit questionable, because strictly speaking, in Buddha Dharma, we say that nothing actually really happened. Nothing truly happens. It's all like human minds perceiving things in certain ways. So, the 44th ancestor was priest Totsu. We say Tosu Gisei Daiyosho. He studied with Fushan Yuen Chen. And if anybody happens to be tracking all these names closely, you might suddenly notice, wait a second. Each of these, you know, say they study with the one from the previous chapter. But Fushan Yuen Chen is not the ancestor of the previous chapter. Red alert! Something fishy is going on, which is a big theme of this story. The 44th ancestor, Totsu, studied with Fushan Yuen Chen. Yuen Chen had him inspect the story of the non-Buddhist asking the Buddha, apart from speech and apart from silence. And he doesn't quote the whole story here, so just, you know, this is at a point in Japan where they're starting to bring up koan stories about previously collected things. This one's a Zen story about the Buddha. I'd imagine it might not be in the Buddha's sutras, but it might be. You know, someone not practicing the Buddha Dharma, so like a Brahmin or something in India, often interacted with the Buddha, questioned the Buddha in these terms. I do not ask about the spoken, and I don't ask about the unspoken. The Buddha just sat there. And this questioner said in praise, "World-honored one, you are very kind, very compassionate, opening up the clouds of my confusion. You have enabled me to attain realization." Then he paid respects and left. Ananda, who was always there, as the Buddha's attendant, subsequently asked Buddha, "What did that person realize that he uttered this praise and left?" And Buddha said, "Like a good horse, he goes as soon as he sees the mere shadow of the whip." This is case 32 in the Mumon Khan collection of koans. So I don't ask about the spoken, and I don't ask about the unspoken. Or you could even say, "I've come here to ask you about what's not spoken or not spoken." And the Buddha remains silent. "Oh, thank you." We have other stories. Like case 24 here, where Zen teacher Feng Shui was asked by a monk, "Speech and silence involve alienation and vagueness. How does one get through without transgression?" Almost the same question, like, apart from speech and silence, what's the way? And Feng Shui said, "I always remember south of the lake in springtime, the 100 flowers fragrant where the partridges call." Sometimes it's like that, which in that story seems very similar to what is the signless sight of awakening. Mm. This picture was painted by scholar Wu. But sometimes, instead of answering with something specific like that, the Buddha just remains silent. So Yuan Zhen asked him to study the story of this non-Buddhist asking the Buddha, aside from speech and aside from silence. After 3 years, after giving him this koan, Yuan Zhen asked him, "Do you remember the case? Try to present it." Totsu was about to speak when Yuan Zhen put his hand over Totsu's mouth. And Totsu was thoroughly enlightened. It's also very similar to yesterday's story, right? Which is where he's grabbed and said, "This is what has form. What is it that, or what has signs? What doesn't have signs?" He's about to speak, and he's about to speak, and then he grabs him and says, "This is what has form." So it's like someone about to speak, getting cut off, sometimes awakens them. Because the words, the meaning is not in the words. So Totsu's initiatory name was I Ching, or Gisei, Totsu Gisei. Totsu means abandoned child. And Gisei means devotion to blue. He was of the Li family in Qingxie. At the age of 6, being unusually bright, he left home and lived at the Miaoxing Monastery. He examined the sutras, and when he was 14, became a monk. He studied Vasubandhu's treatise on the 100 dharmas, but pretty soon he lamented, which is kind of like an Abhidharma text about how the mind works. Pretty soon he lamented, 3 incalculable eons required for complete enlightenment is a long road to travel. The traditional story, to become a Buddha takes these 3 countless eons. It's a long road to travel. Even if I take the trouble, what's the value in it? So he went to Luoyang and listened lectures on the Avatamsaka Sutra, the meaning of which explained everything. maybe it's like his shift from kind of small vehicle to Mahayana. Although traditional Mahayana also says three countless eons. But the Avatamsaka Sutra tends to break down all our ideas about everything in its thousands of pages. Once when he was reading verses in this sutra of the bodhisattvas named Forest, when he, there's a whole bunch of bodhisattvas with Forest in their name. When he came to where it speaks of the self nature of mind, he seriously reflected, the Dharma is separate from words and letters, so how can it be conveyed in lectures? So he gave it up and went traveling to hear talks by Zen teachers of our tradition. And I thought it's a little funny that, you know, they talk about these scriptural schools that are teaching the sutras, and he's like, Dharma is not in words and letters, how could it be conveyed in lectures? So he gave up those lectures and went to listen to Zen lectures with a bunch of words, but words that are like less graspable, like this painting being the signless sight of enlightenment that you don't find in the sutras. At that time, Zen teacher Yuan Qian was at Hui Sheng Peak. One night he dreamed he was raising a green hawk. He thought this was auspicious. The next day, Totsu arrived. Yuan Qian welcomed him courteously and had him investigate the story of the non-Buddhist questioning the Buddha, and so on. The master was thoroughly awakened and made bows. Yuan Qian asked, have you been wonderfully awakened to the subtle functioning? Totsu said, even if I have it, I should vomit it out. At that time, an attendant off to the side said, watching this conversation, said, today, Totsu is like a sick man who is finally able to sweat. It's just another one of these Zen phrases, like, something's being bound and now we can finally release it. We get maybe kind of stinky releasing it, but the sweat cures the sickness. The fever breaks, yeah. It's a healing, kind of messy, but healing thing to sweat. So, again, the teacher says, have you been wonderfully awakened to the subtle functioning? Totsu says, even if I have it, or maybe like, if I had it, I should vomit it out. At that time, the attendant off to the side said, today, he's like a sick man who's finally able to sweat. Totsu said, stop your yapping. If you keep prattling on like this, I will vomit. 3 years later, Yuan Qian brought out the essential teachings of Sao Dung line and revealed them to Totsu. Totsu was in complete accord with them. Yuan Qian entrusted him with Da Yang's portrait, leather shoes, and robe, and ordered, please continue the teaching of the tradition in place of me. Don't remain here long and take good care of it. So he entrusted him with Da Yang's robe and portrait. Da Yang was yesterday's story. So how did this guy Fushan get in here? Why is, you know, Totsu didn't meet Da Yang in person. In our lineage, when we chant in the morning, we say, Taiyo Kyogen Daiyosho Tosu Gise Daiyosho. There's no Fushan in between. This is the mystery. This is the event of this story. Then he composed a verse and presented it to Totsu. The student, Mount Sumeru stands in the great space It's like the Buddhist cosmology, the great mountain that's the center of the universe. Mount Sumeru stands in great space. The sun and moon encircle it. One after another, a host of mountains lean on it. And the white clouds change from time to time. The style of Shaolin Monastery, Bodhidharma's temple, rises and flourishes. The screen that obscured Cao Chi, the sixth ancestor, and Dongshan is rolled up. A golden phoenix lodges in a dragon's nest. How can the moss in the imperial compound be crushed by carts? So, the Soto lineage is now going to flourish here. But it turns out that this teacher, Fushan, who passed on this lineage to him, is a Linji, Rinzai teacher. Who's this link between Taiyo Kyogen and Tosu Gisei. What happened? Yeah, isn't that kind of funny? Yeah. You'll hear the explanation for this. But it's a questionable thing. I tend to agree with you that there are Zen people meeting face to face, these links. What's going on? But there's a kind of special relationship here. He's from, because we don't want to include a Linji person. Maybe that was part of it. But there's a kind of special thing that happened here. Kazan says, well, maybe we should stop. So you have to come back. See what's going on here. Because Kazan, maybe we won't even read all this because Kazan goes on for pages, forgetting all about the story of apart from speech and silence and the Buddha remaining silent, and goes in great detail into this issue of how it is that this this teacher who's not recorded in our lineage acts as kind of like a surrogate parent to pass on something between these two people who never met. So that's why, particularly all this, I brought up all of this about transmission today, because Kazan seems to be, this is the big point of like, what is this about and what's going on here? And like, what are these transmissions anyway? It's kind of a major theme of this particular story. Anything else you'd like to bring up this morning? You've been sitting a long time. Please. It is, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Wait. No, I think it was before, a thing, yeah. Because maybe it was, in a way, it was happening really early on. But maybe people weren't so conscious of it, and who knows how informal it maybe was, just relationships between people. And without being a kind of a self-conscious kind of lineage, And then seems like around the time of the sixth ancestor in China, pretty early on in Chinese Zen, people started becoming conscious of the of lineage as an issue, and face-to-face transmission. Sixth ancestor, which was like the fifth century in China. So there's many things can be said. Some people say, well, it's a Chinese thing because it comes from Confucian values. Because in Confucianism, the family lineage is really, really important. So they kind of like bring in that sentiment into this, into the spiritual realm. I don't know if Taoism emphasizes lineage in the same way. Maybe, and maybe they were influenced by Buddhism and took it on, do you know? Yeah.
Whether it's the man on the street thinking in a garbage can.
Yeah, it's meetings between people. Face to face meetings is the key thing. And so there's some issue about, like, there's some controversy even in this story about these two who are somebody sort of passing on something from somebody else to somebody else, but those two never met. There was always face-to-face meetings, but the surrogate person in between, like you say, should be honored for meeting face-to-face. This afternoon we can get into more of these questions. I think it's true in Vipassana center they don't emphasize so much, but I did once ask Ajahn Amaro, Theravada teacher, about this issue of what about transmission in Theravada. And he said, well, we don't have like a formalized thing like they do in China and Japan and also Tibet. So that makes me think that it's not so much necessarily a Confucian thing, because the specific lineage is really important in Tibet too, in all these Mahayana traditions. And he said in Theravada it's not like a formalized thing, but there is a kind of transmission in terms of teachers and students meeting and practicing with each other and styles getting passed along, and different kind of lineages, but they're not like ritualized and maybe even recorded in the same way. More like an informal lineage. And that's maybe like meeting people on the street and getting changed is a kind of like, it's this sort of underground, it's truly happening, it's true meetings, and yet it's kind of informal way. No one knows how it all were connected to everybody in that way.
Do you know of any other prolific writers that kind of like
Well, there's Chinese Rinzai, like Linji, of many great ancestors. We have their records. And in Japanese Rinzai, Hakuin is like the great reviver who wrote a lot, and so that's partly why he's so well known, because he left so much, and also he kind of restructured the kind of school of Rinzai and made a systematic teaching, and it became really popular. But there's others like Some important ones are Bonke. We have his record in English. Basui. And kind of classical early, before, those are before Hakuin's time. And some people, some of those too, I think, practice with both Soto and Rinzai. But in the end, we're more connected. But they have the same whole list of ancestors and lineage, is, I think, just as emphasized in Rinzai Zen. Although Dogen wrote a lot about this, these issues, so. And Hakuin, interestingly, even though he's like the greatest Rinzai ancestor in Japan, kind of considered like that, it's interesting that he didn't even really have like a formal Dharma transmission. I said, that's amazing. Afterwards, then it became like this thing, but he was just this great and very unusual character, and a little bit renegade, and he definitely practiced with teachers, but he didn't have like a kind of formal thing like that. So I find that that's kind of amazing in a culture, in a spiritual system where that is really important. Even in his time, he kind of like didn't really go that way. So that's an example too of like really great teacher who like doesn't care so much about those issues. And then later it became more formalized. And, yeah, he practiced with a Taoist teacher too, and I think his Rinzai Zen teacher was a very almost unknown person actually, in a little hermitage somewhere. So, and Hakuin's training was very eclectic, and I think his teacher did approve him and so on, but they didn't do a kind of like a formal transmission type of thing. May the light extend equally everywhere. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.